This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
You're listening to the podcast version of Panel Borders, Resonance FM's monthly show about comics, graphic novels, and sequential art. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this episode, you'll hear a pair of interviews that I recorded at the Lakes International Comic Art Festival, or LICAF for short, with popular comic book writer Joe Kelly. In the second of these interviews, which will be coming up later, you'll hear us talk about a variety of different projects that he's worked on, from penning team books such as The Justice League and X-Men, critiquing ultra-violent superhero comics in the pages of Superman, and working on the graphic novel I Kill Giants, which is currently being turned into a movie. However, before that, you'll hear the Q&A that I recorded with Joe before a screening of the Deadpool movie, as Joe's one of the writers who's responsible for Deadpool's early years, and more recently returned to the Merc with a Mouth in the pages of Spider-Man Deadpool. So Joe, I mean, I introduced you as a Deadpool writer, and indeed you were the writer of Deadpool's first ongoing solo comic. Mm-hmm. At that point, you'd only written a couple of 2099 miniseries for Marvel, but this, you know, you were still quite a young creator at that point. Mm-hmm. Was it daunting taking on, you know, a character that was still kind of finding its feet in its way?
Oh, that's a great question. Matt Idelson was the editor at the time, and we had done some work together on What If, and he was in the office for 2099. Excellent science fiction, if you don't know, our 2099 run. But they were taking pitches for a Deadpool comic, and up until that point, they had only done two miniseries, Circle Chase and I forget what the other one is.
Mark Waid, right?
Yeah, Mark Waid's one, which I like quite a bit. And so he said, hey, you know, why don't you pitch for it? And most of the pitches they were getting were focusing on Deadpool as just super violent mercenary killer, like very straight and serious. And at the time, we had the Heroes Reborn universe. Anybody remember that? Mm. Sort of strange experiment comics. So I had a pitch where Deadpool basically beat up Franklin Richards and stole the entire universe just because he wanted this blue ball that he had. And was running around fighting all of the Marvel's worst, like Obnoxio the Clown and Ego the Living Planet, and just the worst that Marvel had to offer. But the humor of it somehow sparked something, and they decided to give me a shot. And it was wonderful to have an opportunity to launch any title, you know. Mm. And then, I don't know how people are here in comic stores. We're not all like the comic book guy in The Simpsons in the States, but there are some. And when issue one came out, my wife wanted to go to the store and buy it from the store with me. And I said, hey, we can do that, but you cannot tell anybody I wrote this. You just can't. So she's like, oh, I don't think you're being so silly. And we go in, and we happen to see a friend. She's like, oh, Joe wrote this. And he was like, oh, yeah, and that was fine. He's a friend of mine. And then we go to the counter, and I'm like, please don't say anything. And she's just shaking. She can't help herself. So I go to buy it, and she's like, he wrote that. Well, 25-year-old kid behind the counter. And he goes, oh, I'm sorry. Why are you sorry? He goes, well, it's from Marvel, so it has to suck. This is why we don't tell people things in the comic store. And I could only say, well, that one doesn't. I had no retort for him. That was it. But luckily, it didn't suck that bad because we got 3 years out of it and a bunch of stories, some of which wound up in the film.
Nice. We think of Deadpool now very much as this character with the irreverent humor, breaking the fourth wall, and so on and so forth. But that wasn't something that came fully formed when you first appeared in New Mutants. Right. How much of that had already been developed at this point, and how much can you take credit for?
Luckily, there are plenty of people who give me credit, so
excellent.
Which is very
okay.
Kind of them. Wade, one of the things in Wade's story that always stood out to me was I think he was the first one to do the thing where when Deadpool's mask was taken off, he freaked out. Like, he couldn't even focus on a fight. He was so upset about his appearance. And that, for me, really gave the character a psychological underpinning that was much more interesting than just, oh, he's Spider-Man with guns, which is kind of what the original sort of intent was. So that really helped influence the dark psychology part, and then I just like humor. And so for me, those kind of things go hand in hand. I love flawed characters, I love funny characters, and I honestly, they thought the book was going to be canceled after issue 6. They told us flat out, like, yeah, do whatever you want. They just didn't even care. You cannot imagine, this is 1997, so just try to imagine a time where nobody knew what Deadpool was and nobody cared what Deadpool was. So we did whatever we wanted, and we flew under the radar until people started to notice our sales were going up, and then they wanted to tell me how to be funny, which was a little scary, but we survived all that and got through about 36 issues. Okay. So.
There is this idea that a lot of Marvel comics are still written using the Marvel method, which, for people who don't know, the idea is the writer comes up with a plot, the artist draws it, and then the writer adds the dialogue to the speech balloons. Was that the way you did Deadpool, or did you do it full script?
I at first did a hybrid because I didn't know, I didn't have a format. There's not anybody who's an aspiring writer. There's no specific format for comic book scripts. So I didn't really have one. So mine was kind of a hybrid where I would describe the panels and then kind of put the dialogue with just within the prose. And then eventually I migrated to something that looks more like a film script. I have worked with artists who wanted to do it, not just Marvel style, but really old Marvel style. I won't say who it was, but they had called me up once and said, can we do it the way Stan used to do it? And I'm like, well, what does that mean? It's like, just tell me something over the phone and then I'll draw whatever I want. So I don't think they'll pay me for that. I don't think I'm allowed to do that. So unfortunately, we couldn't go that way. But yeah, I prefer the full script method because, A, I use a lot of dialogue. If anybody knows my old Deadpool especially, it would cover the art if the artist didn't know what I was going to do. So I love dialogue and to give them room. Ed McGuinness especially, he's very good at leaving the spaces open. So right now we're doing Spider-Man Deadpool together. And it's great to work with Ed again. And it's great to work with this character again. Mm. And Spider-Man was always my favorite growing up. So it's the perfect storm. Mm. And he knows to leave me a lot of space.
Nice.
Because there's a lot of talking in that book.
Because when the Deadpool movie came out, Deadpool co-creator Rob Liefeld, artist, tweeted something along the lines of, the janitor could have written this and it wouldn't make any difference. So presumably you'd disagree with that.
Well, yeah, and that was one that Fabian had to take issue with. And actually, there was a big, huge storm about that, and him and Fabian have always had, you know, they've worked out their relationship a long time ago, and I've never gotten involved in any of that stuff. But no, I think that was about the actual creation of the thing. Rob's always been very kind to me, and he was very excited for the stuff that made it into the film. Mm. Fabian's always been great. I actually only really met him while we were doing like press for Deadpool. If you have the DVD, I'm in it for 30 seconds in a little documentary that I sat there for 3 hours filming. So I don't know where the rest of it is, but it's not there.
Nice. And like you said, you're now writing Spider-Man Deadpool after a gap of a number of years not writing the character. Was there a desire to come back and write for the Muck with the Mouth, or did they ask you?
They asked me.
Okay.
I love mainstream comics, but I'm part of a company called Man of Action. We do animation and film and TV, so we do, and comics, obviously, so we do a bit of everything. And I don't have a ton of bandwidth for mainstream comics, but Nick Lowe, who's the supervising editor, said, hey, it's Spider-Man, Deadpool, and Ed McGuinness. And I was like, that's okay. That's pretty tempting. Yeah, it's kind of hard to say no to that. And the dynamic was very cool because the Deadpool I was used to, and even the Spider-Man I was used to, their status quos are so different right now. Mm. Spider-Man hates Deadpool, certainly in the beginning of our series. Deadpool loves Spider-Man. many levels to that love that I'll let you determine on your own. And so that's a great dynamic, this odd couple dynamic to start with. And then the challenge has been making sure that they each get their limelight, they each get to be funny in their own way, which is the best kind of challenge you could ask for. And it's been really fun. The first trade is out, and even though we are slow, so we do get fill-in issues occasionally. I apologize in advance for fill-in issues, but they're good fill-in issues. Penn and Teller are doing it, or Penn Jillette is doing that fill-in. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. So there's very good fill-ins. I'm assuming that they're out and available already. But it's been great. I mean, it's just been wonderful. And Deadpool being married has made for a lot of different kind of humor. I always describe myself as a shallow writer. I take whatever's happening in my life, and it's kind of immediately on the page. So when I used to write Superman, my editor would say, hey, how are things going in the Kelly house today? And I'm like, I don't know, fine, why? He's like, well, Lois and Clark are really mean to each other this month. I don't know what's going on. And so a lot of that sort of seeped into Deadpool as well, and now I have a new husband-wife team that I can exploit and work out my own therapy through comics. And then Spidey's current status quo is just interesting and different, but he's still at his heart. He's still Peter. He's still fun, you know. So having two of them together has been wonderful.
Mm. I think Ed McGuinness is a really underrated artist. He has the great ability of doing kind of superhero fight scenes, but he also brings a kind of level of humor, kind of cartoony satire to it. And as Deadpool is quite a cartoony character, does it make it easier working with an artist like Ed on a character like Deadpool?
Oh, 100%. When Ed was on the book for basically the first year, we had Pete Woods, who's also an open sort of style artist, and then we had Walter McDaniel. And I love everybody I've worked with. I've been very, very lucky and fortunate. Walter is very, like, super real, almost like photoreal stuff, and it made the dark parts really dark. And with Ed, it balanced out. We got away with some stuff that was very heavy, things that I didn't even remember writing until the movie came out, and then things would come up on the internet about evil things that I did to Deadpool, and I was like, no, I didn't. Oh, I did do that.
How was your life at that point?
my life was bad. It was a dark time. But Ed always balanced that out, which was really helpful. And the same now. I mean, and he's just gotten more dynamic as an artist. I mean, him and Mark Morales are a great team. He's inking most of our book. I hadn't seen Ed's work for a while, and I saw it on Nova, and I was like, wow, he's really improved and got a little more detailed, and he's just finding his way in a new direction. So it's been wonderful, and he's a totally sweet guy. If you ever have a chance to meet Ed McGuinness, he's the most wonderful person, and he has a thick Boston accent. Hey, dude, I'll tell you, he'll call everybody dude. Dude, thank you, dude. So we get a lot of that out of him, but he's a great guy.
Cool. I don't know how long we've got, but if anyone in the audience has any questions for Joe, stick your hand up and shout them out.
Yeah, fire away. The question was, how does it feel to be connected to a character like Deadpool? I obviously can't take credit for creating him. That was Robin Fabian. I'm just very lucky, though, to have gotten to work on the character for so long. And it was really exciting to see. I mean, I did create Blind Al. I did create Ajax. I did create the origin story that essentially is in the film. So to see that stuff played out on screen is really wonderful, and it's an honor, you know. And actually, a friend of mine who happens to be a film producer was talking to one of the writers who didn't realize that we all knew each other. And the producer mentioned my name, and the writer was like, wait, Joe Kelly, like Deadpool Joe Kelly? And he just went off about me and how this wouldn't exist. And it was very kind. And, you know, writers sometimes are... But writers generally are nice to each other, but sometimes people want to just take their credit, take their toys. So it's very, very good community, and people have been really cool about the book. So I'm super proud and just happy that he got his day in the sun, and that they did him right, I think, as just the fact that you're all here, probably seeing it not for the first time, I'd imagine, can attest. So.
And is it more difficult writing him now that he's famous than back in the beginning when he wasn't?
No, the being famous part doesn't put any pressure. The, hey, you used to be funny is the pressure. That's what I'm afraid of. Yeah, 97 was a good year for you, and then that's it. Now I'm dead. That's the pressure.
Okay.
So the actual origin story of after he finds out that he has cancer and goes into the, you know, at the time, this offshoot of the Weapon X program, sort of how we did it. Francis / Ajax running the place. That was all stuff that we did in our run. Like I said, Blind Al, we created from the beginning because we wanted Deadpool to have a butler. And so we thought that, first we'll start with Alfred and we'll make a little dig there at Batman. Then it was, well, he's so upset about his face, he could only have a blind person live with him. And then once I got to Blind Al, we figured, well, he used to be Spider-Man with guns, kind of, so let's make it look a little bit like Aunt May. And then we just set up this insane relationship between the two of them that in the comics gets very dark at parts. They are very light about it here because they really couldn't have gone into it. But, you know, in the comics, she's his willing prisoner. There's like a crazy Stockholm Syndrome thing going on where she feels guilty about stuff that happened to him. And so she stays with him even though she can leave anytime she wants. And so technically he's her prisoner, or she's his prisoner. It's a very dysfunctional relationship. And something that you guys can know that we never got to was that we were eventually going to do a story that revealed that she was the original Black Widow in World War II, and that she had a torrid love affair with Captain America. So, never got to tell
one
that
day.
Story. Untold tales of Blind Al.
Nice. Any other questions?
So I wondered where Deadpool's voice comes from. Quite a distinctive voice and way of talking about the world. Is that from a personal experience or...?
My dark, dark, evil side. his word balloons are yellow because he's supposed to have a raspy voice. So right now I've got Deadpool's actual voice. That voice is definitely like the voice that we all wish we had, like after the fact. You know, like you meet somebody, they really annoy you, and then in the hallway you're like, oh, I should have said that. He just always says that. And because you're a writer, you have the time to sit and actually think those things. I was very heavily influenced by Robin Williams and that kind of improvisational comedy. Bugs Bunny, like literally. I mean, I really did think that there was so much good humor there, physical humor that we could use. But Robin Williams was a huge influence for me growing up. So Robin Williams, George Carlin, yeah, I just kind of mixed it all together in my head. And the idea of a Spider-Man who was just so just nihilistic and just did not care at all, that's what I sort of channel for Deadpool and continue to do, although he's a little lighter at the moment. He's happily married, at least at the moment.
Nice. Any other questions?
Yep.
Were there any characters that you were going to portray and they didn't get used?
Oh, in the comics?
Yeah.
Many. Many. By the time my run wound down, the sales were constantly, there was a basement of about, I think it was 24,000 copies at the time. And we would dip below it and they'd say, I'll wrap it up. And then people would write actual letters, physical letters, because that's how long ago it was. I'm very old. And then they'd say, oh, okay, we'll give you another couple of months. And this went on a few cycles. And then I just couldn't write that way. I couldn't keep going back and forth. And then, shockingly, he survived without me. So clearly, I wasn't important. It could have been the janitor. So, he was just somebody we could play with anything. I would have loved to eventually got to Spider-Man. That would have been one of the characters I would have loved to have worked in. Him with Doctor Strange. I mean, there are so many Marvel characters I love. And we were just actually, it ended on a note where he had, one of his big villains in the book is a character called T-Ray. And we got to a story that basically said he was not Wade Wilson, that he had stolen the Wade Wilson identity from this guy T-Ray, which is why he hated him so much. They immediately ended that the instant I was off the book, which is fine. They have their reasons. But following that trail would have been really fun. I don't know where it would have gone. So.
And I suppose that's always going to be the thing when you're writing a mainstream comic. As much as you love doing it, as much as you love the characters, at any point after you leave, they could just undo everything. And I suppose you just have to have a laissez-faire attitude about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the people who don't just get angry and gnarled and there are other people's toys, you know. But while you're on it, you put your heart and soul into it, you know. And even whether it's Superman or Spider-Man, I've been very, very lucky to get to work on these characters. It's a privilege, and you treat them with respect. You do the best you can. You try to lead them a little bit further along than where you found them. Sometimes an editor has a certain agenda or wants you to work in a certain fashion. And other times I just say, have at it. And that's how it was with Deadpool. So it was a great canvas to work with. And what's been great is certainly over it stood the test of time. People are very complimentary about the run and still go back to it and, you know, sort of acts as some source material. So I'm very proud of it.
Nice. There was someone at the back. Yeah.
Whose idea was it to give him the sort of split personality thought bubbles in his head? And did anyone sort of put it to be in the film at all?
I think that was Daniel Way's run. That was definitely not mine. That came well after me because I don't think Gail did that. Gail Simone, Chris Priest took on after me, and then Gail Simone took on And then, and that might have been Daniel Way. I forget who started the thought bubbles. I don't know if they were going to try to do it in the film. I'm sorry. I wouldn't be shocked if in the next film to throw people off, they would do some of that. They did it in the video game, if you happen to see that. And I thought it worked to some effect. I like the classy speech bubble guy. it's a funny bit. I think it actually works better in something live action than it does on the page. It's a little less distracting.
Like in Annie Hall.
Yeah. Annie Hall and Deadpool.
Cool. Well, so I can save your voice and entreat people to come and do come to the next Q&A that you're doing over the weekend.
Sure.
In the meantime, Joe Kelly, thank you very much.
Thank you all very much and enjoy the movie. Thank you.
Coming up in the second half of the podcast is an interview that I recorded with Joe Kelly the day after our Deadpool Q&A, in which we talk about various other projects he's worked on, from the Justice League to I Kill Giants.
Hello, thank you for having me.
No problem. So if you don't mind us going back way into the mists of time,
sure.
You studied at the Tisch School of Arts, which is part of NYU, and that was a creative writing course?
Yeah, it was specifically dramatic writing, so meaning screenplays and stage plays. They didn't have a TV department when I was there, but they do now. So, writing scripts for television, film, and stage.
Mm. And indeed, you know, you've worked... you've written for film, you've written for animation, you've written comics. So when you're on that course, was it with an eye to write for all media, or were they aware that some of the skills you learned there might be applicable to comics?
I was really going to be a screenwriter.
Okay.
That was the goal. And Marvel, a couple of editors at Marvel Comics reached out to the school to try to set up a workshop. They wanted to get new talent. These younger editors felt like they had seen the same names all the time and they wanted to see somebody different. Mm-hmm. So they sent a letter to our department, and our department head at the time, who was a playwright, really had no interest in comics whatsoever. But her secretary, who I was friendly with, and who had learned to read with Superman comics, we had talked about it, she said, you know, there's this letter with Spider-Man on it, and I think you should get it. So I snuck in and stole it, basically, and read it and saw what it was, and then offered to run this program for them, which, you know, I always tell the story. The more I tell it, eventually somebody, hopefully statute of limitations ran out on mail theft. But I always tell the story because for writers and artists, we tend to be introverted. And if we don't, that was very loud. If we don't go out of our way, step out of our comfort zone and look for opportunities and jump at them when they come, they pass us by. So by running that program, I met these editors. They liked what I was doing in the program because there was about 11 of us. And based on my dialogue, gave me a job dialoguing over Carl Kiesel on a 2099 Fantastic Four comic. That was my first job ever. And then the second year, Brian K. Vaughan came through as an undergrad.
Oh, wow.
So we had a decent little track record for the 2 years we did it. And then the course actually became a regular course within our department, taught every once in a while by myself or DC editors. A couple of guys have taken it over. So it's been really nice to see that. It was the Stan Hatton Project originally was named. To see it continue.
Which is all about setting off bombs in narratives and using the word excelsior whenever you get.
Yes. As much alliteration as the body can endure.
Exactly. I suppose like a lot of people who break into the comics industry in America, you started off writing superhero comics. Did you have an inherent love of the genre, or was it as much a means to an end? Because since then you've written all sorts of different types.
It was definitely the opportunity presented itself. I loved superheroes for sure. I was certainly a fan, but I think my affinities when I was in college at that point were much more Vertigo. Preacher had just come out when I was in college. That book kind of brought me back into comics as a young adult, not like YA stuff, but literal young adult, you know, 23, whatever. And so the darker stuff was more my speed, more mature comics. And in a perfect world, I probably would have magically gone in that direction. But like I said, the means to an end. Like all of a sudden, somebody's offering you a job. And so many of the people I graduated with, even though it's a master's program,
we're all scrambling, hoping we're going to have a job. So I was not certainly looking a gift horse in the mouth. And of course, I have a great love for superhero comics. So I was hoping it was going to be a straight line to Spider-Man. You know, like how quickly can I get to Spider-Man?
Was you got goal. There in the end.
I got there. It took a long time, but I did eventually get there, yeah.
I mean, one of the things that's interesting about superhero comics these days, and maybe it always was the way, is that it amalgamates other genres into the storytelling. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the 2099 books that you worked on presumably had an element of cyberpunk to them. Right. You know, and something like the X-Men can be an alien drama one week, and then it can be a samurai story with Wolverine the next. Sure. So even, you know, starting with those 2099 books, presumably you're aware of the influences of other genres on superheroes.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, the first couple of things I did were sort of random what-ifs. And the what-ifs were, you know, of course, science fiction. Both of those, actually. One was a Hulk story and one was a boy and his robot story. And then 2099 World of Tomorrow was a 8-issue series we did, so again, science fiction. But yeah, the looking for genres, the comics that I enjoyed as a kid, many of them I got from an uncle, and all the stuff he bought, it was everything from War Comics to Archie's and everything in between. I focused on the horror books. I loved Witching Hour. I loved House of Secrets, House of Mystery. I was really obsessed with those, and then Spider-Man and Superman were sort of rounded out his collection. So those were the things that I read over and over and over. But yeah, so horror is something I really love, and suspense. I love working that in, and the psychological aspects of some of those genres. I didn't really read Westerns. I didn't really read the war books. That was never my thing. Not until much later. Garth Ennis's war stories actually... with the first war stories that I ever read, that I was like, oh, I actually want to read these. Yeah. These are special. Yeah.
Indeed. So you've worked on superhero comics that are all about a single character like Deadpool, and then titles that are also about teams such as X-Men and the JLA. You were talking last night about how on Deadpool it allowed you to then add additional characters to his ongoing storyline. Is it easier to write for solo characters or for team books? Because presumably with solo characters you can do that thing of adding additional people to the plot, but with a team book there's so many of them already, it's already a juggling act.
They come with their different challenges. The nice thing about the team book is that if you've run out of ideas for somebody, there's always somebody else who's going to step into the spotlight. So that's very helpful. I don't know which I prefer. In a bubble, they're equal. So in a bubble, I love something like Spider-Man or Deadpool, and I really loved the JLA. I actually had a great time on JLA and X-Men. In reality, depending on where you sit in the pecking order of one of the big... publishers, you have to ask for permission to do things with the characters. They're not really your characters. I mean, they're never your characters because they're owned by somebody else, but you're not really the one steering the ship unless you're writing JLA and Batman. Yeah. Then you can do whatever you want with Batman. I was never in that position. So it worked out well, and I'm just not the kind of person that would go, well, our books sell more than yours, so you should listen. It's just not my vibe. So then it becomes a little difficult. But just from a storytelling point of view, they're equally fun to me. I mean, it's nice to have the big canvas, to have subplots that you know automatically people will care about, as opposed to you have to sort of hope that people like the supporting cast that you built. Justice League Elite is another example of a book that we launched after we'd introduced the Elite. And that book was really all about the soap opera and, you know, major disasters, an alcoholic, and Green Lanterns having Green Arrows having an affair, and that sort of stuff I love. I mean, you know, it was really good to have that interwoven storyline with a crazy superhero story on top of it. So I like them both.
I mean, obviously there are certain individual characters that you're a fan of, like you mentioned Spider-Man, but when you come to a team book, it seems it must be a little bit like fantasy football, where you say, well, I'd like to construct my team of the following characters, and then hopefully you don't hear from editorial that, oh, you can't use so-and-so because they're in hell, and you can't use so-and-so because they're on Mars. You know, but did you generally get the choices you wanted?
Yeah, certainly with the Elite we did, which was, you know, because with the exception of, I mean, Flash and Green Arrow, I was kind of surprised that we were able to get them. The rest of them were invented by us or somebody like Major Disaster nobody was doing anything with, so that was good.
They're currently on the bench, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
When we'll bring them onto the field.
Yeah, when they're on the bench, they're anything goes. X-Men, I was writing with Steve Siegel, and there were two books. So he had we had agreed, he had the classic team and I had the new characters, and then you knew there'd be some overlap with like Wolverine and Nightcrawler, like the characters that everybody sort of loved. But yeah, I've definitely run into it now, you know, like on Spider-Man Deadpool, like trying to find a villain that you can use where you would think, well, what does that matter? But you'll find out, oh, you know, Dan Slott has big plans for X-Villain, so, you know, can't use that guy. And you go from there. But that's okay, you know. Writing with constraints is not really handicapped for me. You know, like you take it and you go, okay, these are the rails. I'll figure out how to work within the rails. Mm. Sometimes it's actually kind of nice. I mean, it forces choices that you think quicker. It's not everything is available to you. So therefore, you can be a little more strategic and tactical.
Yeah. Well, and presumably one of those rails, one of those constraints is the perceived audience of who you're writing for. Yeah. Because you've written children's comics and cartoons, you've written teen superhero comics, and you've written supposed adult comics, whatever that, you know, means. But a comic, I guess, that you're somewhat famous for was an issue of the JLA called Whatever Happened to Truth, Justice, and the American Way, which is kind of a critique of nihilistic, ultra-violent superhero comics. So did you have a certain sense that maybe certain branches of superhero comics actually were no longer for the audience they were being written for, that they'd kind of grown up too much with the people who are reading them and therefore too adult and too violent?
Certainly, that particular issue, and like I said, I like dark comics. Mm. I mean, you know, you don't get darker or funnier than Preacher, but, you know, I like horror, I like deep psychological analysis.
You wouldn't necessarily put that in the hand of a 10-year-old.
No, exactly. And what actually triggered that story for me was less about the... I'd already come to terms with the idea that primarily our audience is older. But it was in response to something I read that really made me feel like if you believed at all in the idea of a superhero, you were stupid. You were naive. Mm-hmm. And it was the way it was presented in this particular comic book that was a dark adult comic book. And so I just felt like and Superman was not my favorite. When I came on to Superman, they said, what do you know about Superman? I said, well, the movies and a couple of comics. They're like, great, you go write Superman. But then I really came to love that character. So the idea that hope or that the aspirational aspects that we hope to imbue these characters with is somehow naive or foolish or whatever, that really got me angry. Mm-hmm. So that's where 775 came from. So the elite... we're sort of an analog of this other team, which we're an analog of the JLA. I mean, it's a bit woven within itself, but that was more where it came from. To the bigger question as to whether or not we need to have more access to comics for younger readers, 100%. And I don't know that it's going to happen in mainstream books, unfortunately. It's always been a challenge, and it's this sort of awful cart before the horse marketing thing where they go, well, we don't know how to market books to kids. They don't sell. Or it's
like, so we won't bother.
Yeah, so we won't bother, and that just proves our point. There's no books for kids. And my son is 15. He's reading some – right now he's reading DC Rebirth titles, and they tend to be on the lighter side, which is nice.
Yeah.
Just at least everybody's not treating each other awfully, you know. Where it just, in the past, everyone on the JLA is not an idiot. And they're not mean. They're not all mean.
Well, that was one criticism that I would have had of DC's New 52. Right. Is, you know, if you've got the opportunity to relaunch the entire universe, why not make it easier to read for new readers rather than actually aim it at an even older audience, which seemed to be insane, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And so far, Rebirth seems to be doing that. I don't know what their overall plans are. Obviously, I'm as much in the dark as anybody else. But what's nice and what I find exciting is that mostly because there's a bit of a renaissance in terms of the type of content that's going out there, you know, Image being one of the publishers at the forefront of this in America, they're willing to try experiments and see what happens. So there seem to be more opportunities for all ages books that really can get kids in early.
Yeah.
And give them quality story. I mean, I hate to make it sound like, you know, gateway drug sort of thing. That's not my intent, but it's, you know, there's cool all ages books out there that when kids find them, they want more, and then they might be interested in a Superman or whatever, something that's a little bit more age appropriate. And if we don't have that, we're foolish, because there's too many other competing media sources, and comics are not appropriately priced for what they are, comparatively speaking. I mean, $4 for a, you know, a 20-page comic is ludicrous. Yeah. You know, but that's what it is, and it's unfortunate. So like Image, for example, putting out trades at $10, you know, smart idea. Try to get, you know, spread the word and try to get these books in people's hands so that they'll actually give them a chance, because they're trying to follow more of like a Japanese mold, I think, of anything is open subject matter, not just superheroes. So yeah, it's complicated. The business of art as commerce is always kind of troubling, and we run into it on animation side too. I mean, what we need to do to sort of maintain a cartoon on the air, it's inevitably a partnership with a toy company and who's the distributors and all that sort of stuff. And in its best form, it's very organic. Everybody's got the same, they're all on the same page. We all want it to be a fun show for kids. In the worst version of it, you have a great idea, you're chugging along, and then somebody appears and says, we need a giraffe with a helicopter. And you're just like, really? Oh, yeah, we did a test subjects, and they love giraffes, and they love helicopters, so put those things together. So anytime we can avoid that, we try to avoid that.
Absolutely. You mentioned animation, and you're part of the writing collective Man of Action. How was that formed?
So I met Duncan Rouleau. He's an artist and a writer. I met Duncan on a Juggernaut one-shot I did for Marvel, and we became fast friends over the phone. It was years before I actually met him in person. Steve Siegel wrote the X-Men same time I did, and Joe Casey came onto Cable the same time we were in the X office. All three of them live in L.A., and they were already kind of friends and had mutual friends. And we started going to the... Marvel and DC both have these big retreats where you sit around and cook up what's going to happen for a year for a given franchise. Sometimes across the whole line, but more often, like, the X-Men people get together, Spider-Man people get together. So, I mean, it's creatively super fun. I mean, you're just sitting there, what crazy stuff can we throw at the wall, and what sticks, and who's got what ideas? So we were doing that and having a good time, and we had all become friends. And then we migrated over to DC, and we were doing it for Superman, and still making up ideas and having a great time. So decided that why not try to take a stab at it on our own. And also, sort of simultaneously, there were a lot of stories. We all had aspirations to also work in film and TV. And there were many stories that were coming out about people being treated poorly, comic book professionals. Essentially, it was just comics were so ghettoized that it was like, well, if you're a comic writer, you can't possibly be a real writer. You know, Neil Gaiman had not yet become Neil Gaiman, you know what I mean? We just thought it was unfortunate. So we thought, well, if we were a company, they would just be forced to look at us differently. And all these things kind of congealed. And then on the lighter side, you know, we had a booth at San Diego Comic-Con, which meant we had a place to sit. And that's a very important thing when you're at Comic-Con for 5 days. So we hung out the shingle, and right away somebody hired us to write some short films. And then we were hired to write X-Men Legends video game. And then almost immediately after that, Cartoon Network, again, looking for new talent, met up with us. Matt Senreich, who is co-creator of Robot Chicken, had brought them over. And so Robot Chicken is our great-grandfather of Ben 10. and that was what got us in the door at Cartoon Network.
The Disney film, Big Hero 6, the writing credit is Man of Action.
which seems something I'm surprised that you got past the WGA.
Well, no, it's just, it's the creative eye credit. It's not
okay.
No, we didn't write the film. Everybody who worked on that film did a tremendous, tremendous job. Duncan and Steve created those characters while they worked on Alpha Flight. Alpha Flight being a Canadian team that debuted in X-Men, they thought, well, it'd be cool. They were heavily influenced by manga and anime as well, and thought it'd be cool to introduce a Japanese team in a Canadian book. So just continuing the tradition, created Big Hero 6. And everybody just sort of forgot about them. And then here we were years later and working on the Avengers cartoon and the Spider-Man cartoon for Marvel, and we were they're asking about who we should bring in as guest stars, and we said, what about, Big Hero 6 as a joke, figuring nobody even would know who that is. And Quesada and Jeff Loeb go, wait, what? What do you know about Big Hero 6? They're like, we created them. What are you talking about? And that's how we found out that they were doing the film. Because we have a good relationship with Marvel and we had worked with them and everything, we got this created by credit, which is definitely it was a coup for us for sure, and very cool of Marvel and Disney to give that acknowledgement, because there are so many movies that come out where they just pretend that these characters
indeed
formed out of thin air, and I find that horribly frustrating. Not even when it's my stuff. To watch Days of Future Past and not see Claremont's name anywhere, even though he gets a cameo in the film. Marvel has literally gotten 30 years of stories out of that one story. They just keep going back to that and mining that. The guy should get a credit, what I mean? So we're very happy and very proud, because it's a wonderful, wonderful film.
Oh, no, absolutely. But it's weird because it's both a credit and a non-credit, unless at the end it says Man of Action are the following people.
Yeah.
You kind of have to Google who you are. Right. So you are getting responsibility, but at the same time, unless you're in the know, you don't know who you are.
Yeah, that's true. But that's, that's a conscious decision on our part. We, the way the sort of collective came together, we decided very early on it was much cooler to say Ben 10 was created by Man of Action.
Yeah.
I hate using that corporate speak of our brand, but we were thinking a little bit about the brand, but I think we also just thought it was fun. And it was the spirit of kind of how we came together. Pretty much everything we do, because we work in pairs, we work in triples, we work all four of us, we work singly. If it's a Man of Action project, it's a Man of Action project. If it started as a comic book, for example, Joe Casey has Officer Down is coming out at the end of the year, which is a very violent, over-the-top, not-for-kids, insane movie. That has a Man of Action credit, but it's obviously written by Joe Casey, and it's created by Joe Casey and Chris Burnham. So we try to keep it so that it's fair for everybody. Duncan and Steve, I think, in that particular case, were very benevolent and that really played by the rules that we've all tried to set up. You talk about these things in theory, and you hope that they're going to implement in practice. And our sort of, for lack of a better term, our socialist model of, everything kind of goes into the central pot. And, if I create a comic book, Man of Action owns it. That's the way we are.
Yeah.
And that's working out extremely well. It's continued to engender, some goodwill. And what we used to do also, we used to compete in pitches, which was awful, because you'd go in and be like, all right, we're interested in a science fiction thing. And each of us would feel compelled to mention the three science fiction things we have. And it would be these ridiculous bake-offs. And who are we competing against? And once we sort of embrace this idea we all own everything, then it doesn't matter. Duncan's got a great idea. Let's get behind Duncan's idea, and it just really equalized the process in a way that removed the ego, took away the bad kind of competitive nature. We have plenty of the good kind when you have ideas you want to fight for and have your voice in there. But it really eliminated a lot of nonsense for us. So crediting things as Man of Action is just the external an externalization of that.
At this festival, you're wearing many hats. I interviewed you on stage before screening of Deadpool because you wrote that comic. You're giving a talk tomorrow about being a co-creator of Ben 10. And in the clock tower, in the brewery, sorry, in the brewery centre, there is an exhibition of the original artwork from I Kill Giants. Is that a project that's particularly one that you're proud of?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I Kill Giants, from the instant I wrote it, it was very, very personal to me. Mm. You know, the origins of that comic, I don't want to, if people haven't read it, I don't want to sort of give away the story. It's about a girl who believes a giant is coming to her town. She's sort of a self-declared outsider and likes Dungeons and Dragons and all this stuff. But she believes a giant is coming and that she has to kill it, and it's about where her fantasy life and real life intersect. And I wrote that book because of things that were going on in my life with my family, and I was a relatively new father. My daughter was about five and very precocious and fun, and so it's always been super personal. And it's very rare that maybe you know, for other writers I'm sure it's different, for myself it's very rare that you get that lightning bolt where you know the whole story immediately, and this happened to be one of those times. And I was with my dad and I was taking him to a physical therapy appointment. He had lost a leg to diabetes, and in the hour that he was in there, on a yellow pad, I wrote the story, like 9 pages that became the outline that eventually became the comic. And then immediately after finishing the comic, I wrote it as a screenplay, just because I loved it so much, and I was working it through and just felt that it was applicable to either medium. And not knowing if I had an artist or not, it seemed like, oh, why not? It was a good exercise. And the screenplay fed the comic, and the comic fed the screenplay. It's been a great process, and it's taken a very long time to get here. So yeah, I'm extremely proud of it. And working with Ken, meeting Ken and discovering him has been a blessing. I mean, he's just an amazing guy and an incredibly talented artist. The book would not be the same without Ken. And sort of the iconic imagery of Barbara with the rabbit ears, that's all Ken. I mean, that came from him.
And when you had that original 9-page idea, and thought there will be a comic book interpretation of this, had you thought of the length of the graphic novel, literally the size of the page it was going to be on, the kind of artist you'd wanted?
No, I knew who I thought I was going to ask to draw it. I had a few friends who were very good with children. Their children looked amazing, and Barbara was younger in the initial outline. She was like 8 or 9. I mean, she was really young. She was just a little bit up from my daughter's age. And then I would show stuff to my friends, and they would say, you cannot get away with an 8 or 9-year-old with this kind of mouth. I'm sorry. Like, not even
comics. Kick-Ass.
Yeah, not even Kick-Ass is the only one that can do it. So she wound up more that tween, you know, 12 to 13 kind of area. And then that friend couldn't do it. And then I had approached some other people, again, seeing work primarily with children. If they had books that featured kids, because I wasn't worried about the giants or anything like that. That part I knew would be fine. It's, can you draw convincing kids who are acting? You know, that's a skill that not everybody has. So we went through a few people who either couldn't do it for schedule purposes, whatever, and then met Ken. And Ken, when he agreed to do it, agreed to draw it for free, which is a very big commitment. It took about 7 months, not including sort of the development of the thing. And he said for him to do that, he would have to draw in a manga style. Was that okay? And I had never pictured it that way. But at that point, it was just, well, if we can get it done, let's get it done. And he showed me what it would look like, obviously, and his design work is exceptional. So I had a lot of confidence moving forward from that point. And like I said, now it is what it is. And we won the International Manga Award for it, so that's pretty cool. So I'm glad Ken stuck to his vision.
Obviously, you've written quite a number of comics now, but in terms of writing comics, there are original graphic novels like I Kill Giants, you've done miniseries, you've done a number of issues of an ongoing series, and I guess each type of comic writing brings its own challenges. Something like I Kill Giants, you knew it was going to have a beginning and a middle and an end, but when you're taking part in an ongoing, you don't know how long you're going to be passed that baton, you know, you're obviously worried about sales and so on. Does that make it difficult, you know, thinking of cliffhangers, thinking of sales, or do you just approach a project as the best way I can write something rather than worrying about the limitations of its production?
Yeah, absolutely. Again, the latter. I have to think about myself and my audience, which really starts with the audience of me. You know,
because it amuses me.
Exactly. Correct. Yeah. I really do not. I don't think in any. Well, maybe we're all writers are a little narcissistic. I guess we all think we have something to say. But I figure if it's going to make me laugh or make me think, somewhere out there somebody's going to respond. When I proceed from the other direction, I almost always get jammed up. When Loeb and I, Jeff Loeb and I were on Superman, he'd always be like, have you seen the numbers? Do you know what the sales are? And I was like, Jeff, I don't want to know. I can't know, because if I start thinking about that, I'm dead in the water.
Yeah.
And same with message
boards. I'll start putting giraffe helicopters in it.
Yeah, exactly. Anything that that takes it out of I'm creating and having fun and puts it into the business side starts to dilute that whole process for me. So, yeah, I've written books that, you know, have sold 1,000 copies, and I've written things that were canceled after 2 issues, and I'm still proud of them all, you know, I mean, because I gave them my best. It's been a challenge. You know, you do have to put the business hat on for the creator-owned books.
Mm.
So, for example, I have a book called Bad Dog, which I love. Adult humor, dark stuff. Kind of my Preacher, really. I mean, like, directly inspired by Preacher. And we were able to get the first trade out over a couple of years. It took a while to get to the first 6 issues. And I have 2 issues that are done, Diego finished, in the can, but that book has never made a penny. So it's kind of hard to justify, like, getting to the next one, even though we love it. Yeah, so yeah. I know we'll get to it. It's a matter of when. And then Four Eyes is another example of a book that has taken a little while to come out. But when it does come out, people buy it. So there's a little more incentive to finish that arc. And I know where both of those stories go. Bad Dog was definitely meant, it was supposed to be the fun book I just, like, you know, dashed off every month, and all my demons get expunged in his cheap therapy. But it has an ending, and I know where it goes. Four Eyes really has a beginning, middle, and end, with the middle being an accordion. You know, if you sort of think of it like the Rocky movies, you know, because it's about a boy who's in a dragon fighting ring in the Great Depression. Very easy concept to sell. You could have battles forever. But I know what the end is, and I always knew what the beginning is. So now we're just trying to get it finished, Max and I. We just want to get it done. So it'll probably be 2 more arcs, and we'll be able to wrap it up. So, yeah, I'm conscious of the business of it. I think now we all try to, when I say we, it's the Man of Action guys, we all try to write in arcs, I think. Because you know if an arc, sometimes it's just a one-off. I mean, Steve has been focused on one-offs, I think, for the last couple of years. And if it's something you think might have legs for something longer, at least you know, okay, this is a complete unit of entertainment. Mm. Even Bad Dog, that first episode, if you look at it, even though it has a depressing ending, it is a complete story.
Mm.
So, you know, the next part would reopen the door to some things. But so at least if it's in an arc, it can stand alone as a trade, then you can see the graphic novel and make your decisions from there. So I always want to make sure it's a complete unit of entertainment. So whatever, however long that, it might mean 3 issues, it might mean 6, but trying to keep them focused is better. And then if somebody likes it, and I have a Jones to do more, then it makes sense to go back in.
Rather than leaving it with a dangling cliffhanger that might never be answered.
Yeah, which sadly I've done. I mean, you know, Steampunk is an example of a book, and that was not really our fault as much as we were doing that book through Cliffhanger when it was an imprint, and it was an expensive book. Production value was through the roof. Bocello was doing an amazing job, and the sales threshold for that book was like 40,000. And if we had been a Vertigo book where the sales threshold was like 25,000, we would have gotten through all 25 issues. You know, because again, that was plotted out completely. But we didn't. So now it's just sort of hanging there. And people still ask about steampunk, which I love. I mean, this book is quite old at this point. And one day I hope we're going to get to finish it. But steampunk, Bad Dog, like I have a few of these orphans that, and they do, they gnaw at the back of your brain because you know, like, I just want to finish it. It's a great story. Whereas I Kill Giants, because I did it all up front and front loaded it, it got finished. So now that's kind of my MO. I sit on things. I used to get very excited and contact artists too early. And now I just write the thing. Partly because I can. You know, we have other sources of income, and obviously working on animation, you're on that schedule anyway, so you're trying to fit in your personal writing when you can. But mostly so that I know it's finished, and then when I hand it off to an artist, they can see the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then when we go to Image, for example, we can say, this is it. Are you happy? You know, and I know the book will come out, so I have no guilt. I'm sadly someone who both thrives on and despises my own guilt. And I try to eliminate that as often as possible. So that's the new MO, finish, just finish.
Nice. Joe Kelly, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can find more information about Joe Kelly's work as part of the group Man of Action by going to manofaction.tv. The two interviews with Joe Kelly were recorded at the Lakes International Comic Art Festival, or LICAF for short, a fantastic comic book festival which takes place in Kendal in the Lake District every year and returns this year from the 13th to the 15th of October. Guests this year include Jason, Stan Sakai, Peter Milligan, Sergio Aragones, Melinda Gebbie, Brian and Mary Tolbert, and many more. I'll be hosting interviews and panel discussions on stage with a variety of creators, including Hannah Berry, Daryl Cunningham, Fumio Obata, Michael Cho, Mariko Tamaki, and Emma Viacelli, and you can find information about all of the events taking place as part of LICAF by going to comicartfestival.com. But if you don't make it that far north, at Gosh Comics, Monday, October the 16th, Chip Zdarsky will be signing his work and talking about his career so far with writer Kieran Gillen, and that's on Monday, October the 16th, from 6 p.m. For more information about all Gosh events, please go to goshlondon.com. At Orbital Comics, 8 Great Newport Street near Leicester Square Tube, on the 23rd of October, comic book artist Sean Murphy will be in the shop, known for such titles as Batman, Tokyo Ghost, and The Wake. He'll be signing his titles from 5 to 7 p.m. Then on October the 27th, there's a live drawing class in Orbital in which they'll be teaching people how to draw godly characters like the Mighty Thor. There are links for tickets to all of these events on Orbital's website, where you can also find information about this month's exhibition taking place in the Orbital Gallery, which includes original art from Shaky Kane, as he celebrates the launch of a collection of his Deadline strips called Godhead. For more information about all Orbital events, please go to orbitalcomics.com. Just down the road at the Forbidden Planet Megastore on Shaftesbury Avenue, Armando Iannucci will be in store on the 24th of October, signing the graphic novel The Death of Stalin, which he's recently converted into a movie that'll be released in cinemas later this month. And the signing starts at 6 p.m. The next day, at the same time, on Wednesday the 25th, Ian Edginton will be signing a new Iron Maiden comic at the London store. And then on Saturday the 28th of October, creators Peter Milligan, David Barnett, Martin Simmons, and musicians Will Potter and Carl Putnam from Cud will be signing the Black Crown Quarterly, a new comics anthology being published by IDW, in Forbidden Planet on Saturday the 28th of October from 1 p.m. For more information about all Forbidden Planet events, please go to forbiddenplanet.com/events. Panel Borders was recorded, edited, and introduced by Alex Fitch, and is a Panel Borders production. You can find all previous episodes on our blog, www.panelborders.com. .wordpress.com. And if you'd like to support the running of the show, please go to patreon.com/panelborders, where for a small monthly stipend, you'll get exclusive behind-the-scenes extracts, transcripts, and information about forthcoming Panel Borders-related events.
We'll be back on air on the first Wednesday in November with a show celebrating the work of British publisher Myriad Editions, including interviews with Gareth Brooks, Ottilie Hainsworth, and Una. Thanks for listening.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.